So we're going to move on to the presentations today. And first, I would like to introduce Dr. Michael Unger, an associate professor of marine sciences at the Virginia Institute of Marine Science. He's active in teaching, research, and advisory services related to the environmental contaminant issues in the Chesapeake Bay. His research interests include analytical method development, including biosensors, contaminant partitioning behavior, toxicity studies to assess the effects of contaminants, and long-term fate studies to assess regulatory actions. He studied PAHs in the Elizabeth River in Virginia for over 25 years, and his recent research is focused on the development of antibody-based sensors for the near real-time analysis of environmental contaminants. Mike, I'm going to now turn it over to you.
Thank you very much, and I really appreciate this opportunity to talk about our SRP-funded research and developing biosensors to look at pH, fate, and toxicity at contaminated sediment sites. What I'm going to cover today is a little bit about pHs and their importance as environmental contaminants, talk about the pH biosensor we're using and what exactly that is and how do we make the antibodies that are used in the sensor, and then give some examples of applications of the biosensor technology to look at pH, fate, and transport at field sites in the Elizabeth River in particular, and then also some new work we're doing to look at it as a potential oil spill detection method working with industry. And then I'm going to give some examples of applying the biosensor to look at pH, bioavailability, and toxicity in contaminated sediments, and that works in Baltimore Harbor. And then I'm going to finish with some of our current and future work where we're looking at developing the biosensor technology as a way to look at bioaccumulation in bivalves and also as a potential soil screening method for flood sites, and that work in conjunction with Texas A&M University. And then I'll sum up with a little bit of the development that we're ongoing and some of the fate and toxicity work that we're planning for the future. So to start with, our target contaminants for our biosensor work right now are polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. They're not new and emerging like a lot of things that people are studying right now, but they've been around since organic matter has been on Earth. They're potentially toxic and carcinogenic. They were first, combustion products were first associated actually in the 1770s with skin cancer and chimney sweeps. So they've been around a long time, and they've been recognized as common targets for Superfund cleanup, and historically they've driven many of the Superfund cleanups. And oysters and estuarine environments are potential vectors for human exposure. Sources can include combustion products, creosote, and oil. Polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons are hydrophobic chemicals. They have very limited water solubility, so they have low concentrations in water. And under equilibrium or steady state conditions, we see low concentrations in the water and high concentrations in lipid materials, organic-rich sediments, and things like organisms. So kind of the focus of our SRP-funded research has been to develop technology so we can better predict pH, fate, and bioaccumulation at contaminated sediment sites. So that's really been the focus of a lot of our work. The reason for this is a typical scenario of how we would analyze a sample in my lab or many labs around the country to look at polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons or other hydrophobic chemicals. It's slow and expensive. It literally takes weeks to produce data. Environmental samples are extremely complex with hundreds of thousands of compounds. We must extract them, separate them, target our analytes of interest. And this whole process can take, like I say, weeks and not months to produce data sets and can be very expensive because of it. It's often the cost, the limiting factor, the cost of analytical analysis and environmental studies. So the focus of our research has been to develop a biosensor. And a biosensor, by our definition, the bio part are monoclonal antibodies against contaminants. And the sensor part is an electronic instrument which is capable of detecting and enumerating the antibody binding to the antigen. So how do we make antibodies to small molecules like PAHs? Well, it's problematic at first because the small molecules that we're targeting are not immunogenic. The immune system doesn't respond to small molecules like PAHs. It responds to things like large things like bacteria and viruses. And to fool the immune system into producing antibodies specific to small molecules, we take a compound that's analogous to our compound of choice with a tail on it, where we can bind it to a protein molecule. So we end up with a large immunogenic molecule coated on the surface with the compounds of interest. In our case, let me get a pointer going here. I can't get it. So in our case, we're using, there we go, thank you. In our case, we're using something like a PAH with a tail on it, binding it to the protein, so we end up with something that's immunogenic, and we can produce antibodies that then have binding pockets that will bind the free contaminant. So we take this initial protein with the pollutant on the surface of it, immunize a mouse, monitor its sera over time, and until we recognize that we're getting a high affinity for the compounds of concern, then we can take those antibody-producing cells, fuse them in a hybridoma, and end up with a cell culture that provides an endless supply of antibodies that we can now use as a reagent. This process can take up to months, but we've done some research to look at shortening this down, and we can actually get it down to about 7 weeks if everything goes really well. Once we have our antibodies, this is the instrument that we've been using, and it's produced by Sapodyne Instruments in Boise, Idaho. They're our industry partner. And the key to this is we have automated sample handling, precise fluidics, and we also have put a fluorescent tag on the antibody. You can measure the binding response in the detector. To run you through how this works, here's an animated cartoon to show you the process. So we'll take beads coated with our competing antigen, something similar to our pH of interest, take a water sample, in this case a sample with no pHs in it, mix it with the antibody in the instrument, and most of the antibody sticks and we get a high signal. We repack it with new beads, again with competing antigen, mix our sample with antibody in the instrument. This time the antibody's bound, so we get a low signal. So this is actually the opposite of most analytical instruments. It's a competitive assay, so the higher the signal, the lower the concentration in the sample. The beauty of this technology is that it's extremely sensitive. It has good correlation to GC-MS, and the antibody of choice that we're using right now is one we developed in our lab. This is called 2G8. It has a high affinity for a wide range of pH, both alkylated and non-alkylated, 3 to 5 rings. So we get a good measure of the total pH concentration in the sample. We can look at very small samples, 1 to 5 mils, and that whole process that we just went over takes about 8 minutes. And we can look down to approximately 0.1 parts per billion total pH concentration. So it's very sensitive, and we're using it for environmental fate studies and toxicity evaluation. Our study site that we've been spending much of our time with is the Elizabeth River, which is in the southern part of the Chesapeake Bay, and it contains a wide range of pH contamination, and it's under various stages of ongoing sediment remediation, some of it voluntary, some of it Superfund sites like Atlantic Wood Industries. The surface sediments in some of our remediated sites meet criteria for pH remediation. They've been dredged and capped, but we noticed that in some of these areas, especially in our Money Point sites here, we still see high concentrations of PAHs in the pore water, even though the concentrations in the total sediment levels are actually quite low. So we needed better methods to better understand and predict pH transport in sediment remediation sites like this to assure the long-term success of the remediation efforts. And this is where we've taken our biosensors to do a lot of work. So we can go into a site like this, collect environmental samples with something like a PONAR sampler, squeeze the pore water samples out, get a small volume, run it on the biosensor, and do it on site. And we've done that at our study site I just showed you. We can produce data like this. So this is Money Point Phase 2 at our Elizabeth River site, and we've mapped out the pH concentrations. Here's pore water concentrations shown as circles here in this figure. And we've also looked at surface water and near bottom water and done this all in one day at one site. So we can go into a site and literally map the pH concentrations of site and do it in a day. In this case, I think we ran approximately near 30 samples. So we've done this at several sites. Because of the high pore water concentrations, we became interested in what was happening within the sediments that was driving the transport of the pHs within the sediment. So here we took a dry point pisciometer, press that into the sediment, open up the tip. We can take a small water sample, filter it, run portion of it on the biosensor to get pH concentrations, and take a subset and look at the salinity in a refractometer. Our system is an estuarine system, tidally driven. And what we get is data like this. And this is our sampling sites in one of our remediate areas. This is area that was remediated here in phase two. In phase three, it's targeted for future remediation. And what we found was that the pH concentration increased with, here's pH concentration on the x-axis, with depth within the sediments at almost all of our sites. Site six here, we found that the pH concentrations were very low, so we didn't look like there was a source there. But it looks like contaminated fresh water and groundwater at depth is mixing with less contaminated estuarine surface water at this particular site. And if you look at the pH concentration versus salinity, we see they're inversely related. So it looks like surface saline water is mixing with more contaminated fresh pore water at depth in the sediments. So our next phase to use the technology was to look at what was actually coming out of the sediments and into the surface water, which could be biologically available to organisms like oysters on the surface. So for this, we deployed seepage meters, and because of the small volume samples, we could collect samples hourly and measure them on the biosensor. And what we found was data like this. This is MPF2. This is one of our dredged and capped sites. And it actually had very low pH concentrations in the surface sediments because of the sandy cap, but some of the highest pore water concentrations and some of the highest flux measurements. Because we can measure the mils per hour coming out of the seepage meter, and we can measure the concentration of small volume, we could actually analyze and calculate the flux coming out of the sediments. And what we found is that the flux was proportional to the flow rate. Our flow rate was proportional to water height. At times of low tide, we had high flow rates, and at times of high tide, we had low flow rates. So it looks like tidal pumping is driving this advection within the sediments and increasing the flux to the surface. So what we're seeing is that this biosensor data is helping us to understand the dynamics of pH flow through the sediment. It's helping us now guide future remediation plans, and which should limit flux to the water column. And we also have identified problem areas that when this will be remediated in the future, we can go back to these problem areas and address areas where we have high contaminant flux to the water column. One of the other things that we've started looking at with the sensor is its ability to potentially understand the fate and effects of oil. And to do this, we've collaborated some with ExxonMobil, and oil is interesting. It has a very complex fate once it enters the marine environment, but dissolution is important in terms of exposure and bioavailability to aquatic organisms. So what dissolves in the water column in particular is PAHs that are in this complex mixture. They may be a small percentage of the total hydrocarbons in something like crude oil, but they're a large percentage of the dissolved fraction, the potentially toxic fraction that is released during an oil spill. And through this work, we have found that we analyzed some water accommodated fractions produced by ExxonMobil, and they predicted the 3 to 5 ring pH concentrations that would be released into the water. We analyzed these within one day in the biosensor and found good correlation between the predicted concentrations and the biosensor measured concentrations from different sources of oil and different weathering rates of oil. We also did some work at a field trial with them at the OMSET BC facility up in New Jersey, where they did a subsurface release of oil and were looking at the concentrations over time as it was transported in this wave tank. The blue line here represents pH concentrations we measured as the plume went by. So these are the dissolved pH concentrations. And the red dots are pH concentrations measured by GCMS, which took weeks to get back from the lab. So in near real time, we could document the pH concentrations being evolved from this oil spill. So we've used the biosensor to look at pH mechanisms that are controlling the fate and transport of pH in water and sediments. How does this relate to bioavailability and toxicity? For this, I'm going to go back a mere 450 years or so to Paracelsus, the father of toxicology. And he was the one of the first to identify the idea that all substances are potentially poisons and that the dose makes the poison. It's a simple concept that we recognize in toxicology today. However, what is the dose in contaminated sediment? That's a little more difficult to better understand. There's an excellent paper by Jose Ortega Calvo and colleagues that came out in 2015, and there was also a special session in 2017 at CTEC Europe that looked at addressing the gaps between the state of science and the regulatory community and understanding the relationship between bioavailability and regulatory criteria for understanding the toxicity of contaminated sediments. And the idea behind this is that when you look at a whole sediment and we go ahead and extract it by a typical organic analysis like I showed you earlier, we don't even get all the contaminants like the pHs that are in that sediment. There's some that is not extractable by organic solvent alone. And then we're also extracting some things that are probably not bioavailable to organisms in that sediment. So there's techniques like mild extraction techniques and in particular passive sampling techniques that have been developed to get a better idea of the bioavailable fraction in the sediment. And as if you look as we go through here, it's probably this dissolved or free dissolve phase that's getting across cell membranes and causing toxicity or a biological response and controlling bioavailability. And the concentrations decrease as we go this way. So one of our questions was, if this is the case that the freely dissolved fraction in pore water is an important measure of the toxic fraction in sediments, we were wondering if our biosensor could be used to measure this. So one of the things that we've done is collaborated with Lance Yonkos and students in his lab at the University of Maryland, where they were doing a study looking at the toxicity of contaminated sediments in Baltimore Harbor. Baltimore Harbor has high concentrations of PAHs and also various metals. So we took samples from there and measured the pore water concentrations by biosensor. We found good correlation between our pH concentration, the size of the dots here, and the toxicity, the red being the more toxic samples. So there was a good correlation. There was also a good correlation between toxicity and nickel, chromium, and total petroleum hydrocarbon concentration. So pHs alone either are not driving this toxicity or maybe contributing to it. So to get a handle on that, we looked at the total pH concentrations, the various compounds in those samples, and produced a spike of 18 compounds across the spectrum of pHs that were there and adjusted the concentrations to the total pH concentrations that we saw in the field. And this is the data we found from those experiments. What was interesting was that the total pH concentration in the sediment, like the science is telling us now, does not accurately predict the toxicity to Leptochirus in a 10-day toxicity test, but what we're measuring with the biosensor in the pore water does a much better job of predicting the toxicity. At this particular site, we're finding that the concentrations in our field samples were actually much lower in pHs when they were toxic. So we were thinking that pHs and metals combined are probably contributing to the toxicity at this site. We're doing some work now looking at sites in the field that are predominantly contaminated with pHs with less metals to see if this still holds. Another thing to notice is that the mortality curves are very steep for these compounds. These pHs are narcotics, and this is really typical. So once we get much above 10 parts per billion total pH in the pore water, we're starting to see toxicity in these samples. Some of the new research that we're involved with now, this is some work for being conducted by our Superfund research program trainee at VIMS, Kristen Prosner. She's a graduate student, and she became interested in whether or not we could use this technology to measure pH concentrations in organisms. And in particular, she was interested from a policy standpoint to come up with a fast quantitative analysis. The current state of the knowledge, and this is typical of what happened after Deepwater Horizon spill, was that for fast analysis, the best thing available was something like a sniff test, where trained investigators actually smell seafood to determine if they're contaminated with oil. The alternative is the GCMS tissue analysis, like we showed earlier, which is very slow and can take weeks or not or up to months for to produce large data sets. So needless to say, the public has distrust from inaccurate or slow responses during spills or flood events and want to know more rapidly whether or not their seafood's been contaminated. So from a policy standpoint, a fast quantitative analysis would bring back stakeholders and build trust. And from a science standpoint, if we had a sensitive method with the biosensor, we might be able to actually look at individual animals and not just composite samples. We may be able to look at temporal scales not possible by GCMS. So the idea behind this stems from our same idea of partitioning that goes on in the environment. We know that at equilibrium, we can measure the concentration of one compartment like the water and then predict what would be in something like the lipid content of an organism or maybe the organic content in a sediment. So we were wondering, does this same thing hold true in a bivalve? So is the aqueous phase in a bivalve proportional to the concentrations that would be in the lipids that we'd measure in a complete organic solvent extraction? And so what Kristen has done is taken the mantle fluid or the aqueous phase out of animals, pass it through a filter, run it directly on the biosensor, and then taking six of those individual animals she analyzed by the biosensor, making it homogenous so we get a sufficient sample to run it through the standard techniques we use for GCMS. And this is the kind of data we're starting to get. And so what you can see here is the concentration measured in the aqueous phase of the oysters, and this is the concentration by a standard GCMS analysis, whole tissue pH concentrations. So the slope of this line is essentially the partitioning coefficient between the aqueous phase and the lipid phase in the organism, and allows us to predict potentially pH concentrations and do it in minutes. This whole data set could easily be done in a day, individual animals in just a few minutes, and this data set took weeks to get. So you can see the potential advantages to this analysis. One of the things we did find, there's quite a variability in looking at, this is the mean of six animals, looking at the concentrations. There's quite a bit of variability for a given site. And what we found was that the pH concentrations varied between individuals. And we were wondering if this was just a function of noise in the analytical technique or actual real variation in the organisms. So what Kristen did is looked at analytical replicates at one of these sites, and what we found was that the analytical replicates are very tight, so we're probably looking at real differences in individual organisms from various sites. The mean concentrations still hold for the various sites in Elizabeth River or environmentally experimentally exposed organisms, and those correlate well with GCMS. So that looks very promising. Other new research that we're involved with is collaborations with Texas A&M University at their SRP Center, and with Tony Knapp and Krissa Camargo, who is an SRP trainee, and Casey Donnelly Fellow. She came to work with us at VIMS, and she's interested in looking at pH concentrations in soils and sediments and understanding the effect of flood events at the TAMU SRP Center there. So she's working on developing the technique for looking at soils and sediments as a great way to essentially delineate concentrations in the field so we can understand high concentrations, where those are, prioritize those for GCMS analysis for specific compounds to delineate sources. So we potentially can go in and map pH gradients and do it after flood events. And we're planning on scheduling for the summer or fall of this year to take the sensor down to Houston and collect data in near real time and help them map pH concentrations. Lessons learned from studying the flooded areas like in Houston have potential advice flood-prone areas like Chesapeake Bay, where there's a great concern of from sea level rise and increasing effects of spills related to flood events. So we're hoping that things that we learn in Houston can be translated to future work in Virginia and Maryland. So in summary, we have a technique where we can look at pH concentrations in minutes from small volume samples. It's allowing us to look at spatial and temporal measurements not possible by conventional GCMS methods. There's good correlation with GC-MS analysis and split samples. We're mapping concentrations, gradients in the water column and actually within sediments, and can measure flux directly. It also looks like it can provide a measure of the toxic or bioavailable fraction in sediments. It's similar in instrumentation costs to conventional analysis, but individual samples can be run in minutes for much less cost as an individual sample basis. And it's a green technology, no solvents are involved. It's really helping us prioritize samples for compound-specific GC-MS analysis. My lab no longer runs non-detects. We know what the total concentration is ahead of time. When we need specific compound analysis, we can pick the samples to do that with. So that's one of the great advantages to the technology in itself. And in summary, the sediment remediation needs that we've learned by using this technology is that bioavailability is governed by contaminant partitioning and transport. And whole sediment measurements, which have been historically used for assessing remediation effectiveness, are probably not good for assessing the effectiveness of remediation and exposure to biota in humans. It's what ends up in the water column and is biologically available to organisms that's important. To reduce contaminant bioavailability and flux to the water column should be the metrics for success. So we are now advising environmental managers on the need for redefining regulatory goals to reflect this. And we're using that now in the Elizabeth River to address problem areas from previous remediation and also to target things like mitigating pore water transport, things like sorptive amendments to sediments for better remediation in the future. In closing, the biosensor hardware development is something that's still ongoing. Colleagues from Sapodyne Instruments were at our lab last week, and we're still working on developing a more portable battery-operated machine, the smaller the better. And we're doing additional work to look at the viability of detecting oil spills and sediment toxicity. In particular, we're looking at the biosensor measurements relative to other cost-saving methods like solid phase extraction and seeing how that compares to toxicity. And we're looking at developing new antibodies for other hydrocarbons, potentially PFAS compounds, and maybe even haptoxins. And it looks like my time is up, and I'd like to acknowledge SRP program for funding this research and our multitude of colleagues at VIMS and other academic and industry, which have all contributed to this development and application of this technology. With that, I think I have some time to take some questions.
Mike, thank you so much. That was a great presentation, really informative. Certainly appreciate it. Actually, if I could start out with a question. Again, this is Carl Gustafson. I'm the moderator here.
Sure.
You know, one of the things that you were talking about was I know you'd mentioned you were squeezing the pore water from sediment, and also noted that you used the mantle fluid from oysters, and it seemed like this was a direct inject into the analyzer you were using, and I'm wondering what type of sensitivity, like fouling or interferences, does that system have? And as you run your analyses, do you have to switch out the antibody column each time, or kind of how does that work in practice?
Sure, good question. So essentially, that's kind of the beauty of this is there is no real cleanup. If we have a lot of particulates, we'll put it through a Teflon filter. Because that can sort of gunk up the works, as we say. Every time we run a sample, there's a new aliquot of antibody. There's a reservoir in the instrument that we fill with antibody for the day. And every time we run a sample, a little bit of that antibody mixes with that aqueous phase in the sample before it's passed through the detector. So the beauty of it is the selectivity is a function of the affinity of the antibody for the target compounds. So and pore water and things like mantle fluid are probably about as bad as you can get in terms of potentially interfering compounds and interfering matrix effects. And because of the great affinity of the antibody for our target analytes, we see very little issues. Occasionally, I would say probably one of the limiting factors with this is the detector response is fairly narrow. So if we have high concentrations, we have to dilute back into our analytical or quantitative range. And as an aquachemist, that's actually a good problem to have. It's usually the other way around that becomes a problem. but very little interferences with things like pore water or the oyster sample so far.
That's interesting, and I had a question from a questioner that's related to that about what happens if there's going to be NAPL in the pore water. Does that interfere with the sensor?
A lot of our samples do have NAPL, and this is one of the issues that we're having, like at our remediated sites where we're seeing high pore water concentrations. And typically it's not an issue because we're just looking at the aqueous phase, and any sample that's got NAPL in it's very high, and we end up diluting the sample way down to get into the concentration range. So a lot of our samples do have NAPL, and the NAPL itself isn't introduced into the machine. We're looking at the dissolved aqueous fraction.
Right, interesting. Thank you. A couple questions on alternate media for this type of analysis. Is it possible to use this technique on soil samples?
Yeah, and that's what we're working on with Texas A&M, and Chris is working on that. Is some of the soil samples that we had from Texas had enough residual water, so we could actually we've got it down to the point where we can actually just use a milliliter of sample. And then we've done some initial work on an aqueous extraction where we had a group of samples where we had some residual water, and then we rehydrated those samples overnight and reanalyzed them the next day and got very similar results. So it looks like even in fairly dry soil samples, we can do an aqueous extraction and look at that aqueous phase. And that's one of the areas that we're working on currently with Texas A&M, to come up with a fast, easy aqueous extraction that we can then run on the sensor.
Great, Mike, thank you. Also, will the biosensor work in air samples?
No, it will not work in air samples. I think if you collect, potentially if we had something like an air sample collected on a filter, we could do some kind of aqueous extract and then run it. But the system is based on aqueous samples and an antibody dissolved in an aqueous sample. So it's not going to work on an air sample directly. But, if we can come up with a way to do soils, we may be able to come up with a way to do something like a aqueous extraction of something like a filter surface or something like that.
So as we run sort of the gamut on potential media and applications, sometimes when we pull a sediment sample, a core of samples, we can't typically assume that the pore water comes directly from, or in some applications directly from the associated sediment. So are you able to take a sediment sample and use this directly on sediment, or how would you perform that application?
So again, I guess I'm a little, we've done core sections, and we've done sediment grabs. We've also done things, like I say, again, re-equilibrating the sediment with water and analyzing it after the fact and looked at the concentrations this way. I guess maybe I'll have a question for you to clarify a little bit about the collection of the pore water samples again. I'm confused why you don't have pore water in the sediment.
Right. So that, I think that's a good question. I think that sometimes after the sampling, the core tubes might get manipulated to the point that you can't entirely trust that the pore water that you pull would be the interstitial water of that exact point in the sediment. So if you ran into that where you had problems with the sort of sediment, whether or not the core drained or was transported poorly, whether or not you were able to do what you just mentioned about reconstituting the sample. Sounds like you could use that as an application.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, you could take those core sections and rehydrate them, let it equilibrate, and then run that aqueous phase.
Okay, great. So for your biosensor, how does it compare to passive samplers that are used in the sediment and bottom water to estimate pH concentrations and transport?
We've done a little bit of that, and they do correlate. The thing is that we need to take it's sampling something different. We're looking at discrete samples in time, and one of the things that we're finding is that you know, one of the advantages of a passive sampler is you get that time-integrated sample. So like at our site where we had tidal pumping going on, we wouldn't realize that with the passive samplers very easily. By being able to take discrete samples over time, we're seeing that there's great differences in the contaminant flux as a function of tide, for instance, at our site. So we're getting temporal resolution that you don't get with a passive sampler. But if you sample over time and you look at the mean concentrations, we're seeing similar trends at our various stations between the biosensor flux measurements and the passive sampler concentrations.
Great, thank you. Can you tell me, do you have a sense for what pH compounds are going to be captured by this method?
Yeah, most, you know, we've done quite a bit of work on that. 3 to 5 ring, both alkylated and parent compounds. The affinity for 2-ring compounds, like naphthalene alone, is much lower than it is for 3 to 5 ring compounds. What we find is that the 3 to 5 ring are pretty good for getting a feel for total concentrations that might be important for bioaccumulation and toxicity. In something like a fresh oil sample where you had a predominance of naphthalene, for instance, the biosensor would tend to read low relative to the total naphthalene concentration. Another interesting fact that we've kind of found over time is that for pH measurements by the biosensor, it typically is biased high relative to totals by GCMS. And at first, we wondered if there was a problem with us looking at potentially binding non-specific binding to things besides pHs. But what we really learned is that the pH concentrations are by GCMS are limited to a hit list of compounds. And if you look at a total ion chromatogram, there's literally hundreds upon hundreds of pHs in those samples in the environment, and our totals are biased to a hit list that we look at when we sum up our total concentration. So if anything, the biosensor might be actually giving us a better, truer feel for the total available pH concentration in the 3 to 5 ring realm that might be contributing to toxicity over a GCMS analysis.
That's great. Thank you. We're running a little bit low on time, but I think we have time for a couple more quick questions. And one of them is, can you talk about your seepage meter and how it was deployed?
Sure. It's a fairly standard seepage meter. So what that is the top of a 55-gallon drum cut off. And then what we do is press that in place, leaving a little head space into the sediment. And we use a Teflon line and a Teflon bag to collect our sample. We let it equilibrate for a while before we usually put them out in the field and don't collect samples for that first time after deployment. And then install a Teflon bag on the Teflon tube. And we have that set up with a float so we can actually sample through a tidal cycle. So we can go in and pick up the Teflon bag with a float and collect samples throughout a tidal cycle. So we'll spend a day through a tide cycle to collect samples every hour.
Great, thanks. And can you mention whether or not the technology is being transferred to commercial suppliers or whether or not there are efforts to make this into a standard method?
Yeah, I would say the Sapodyne Corporation, that our company that produces the sensor that we're using, what we have now is currently available, but we're continually evolving it to make it better. The instrument is sort of a pseudo field instrument, in my opinion, right now. We take it in the field and run it with an inverter. So we're working on a smaller, with them, on coming up with a smaller, battery-operated, easier-to-use instrument in the field, and that's the ultimate goal. As far as the antibodies are concerned, we've worked with commercial labs to see with our cell line to see if they can produce our antibody, and that can be done. So as the interest grows, I think the availability will grow in the instrumentation and the antibodies. So other folks, and that's ultimately our goal, is to get this in the hands of people so they can use it in real-world applications.
Great, thank you. Finally, one last question. Any hope for the PFAS or other fluorinated compounds using the antibody approach?
Boy, I hope so. That's actually one of my goals. We're working on that. We're working on the feasibility of that right now. So it's you know, analytically they're problematic because there's so many different compounds, and we're going to take maybe a little more novel approach and see if we can go after portions of the molecules that are conserved, like we have with PAHs, which is not the typical way to develop antibodies. Typically, people are looking for something very compound specific. I'm hoping that we can come up with something that's sort of a universal PFAS detector, and I think that would be extremely valuable for successful. I think it's fairly high risk, extremely high gain if we can come up with something.
Great, thank you. So there's a lot of interest in your presentation. There are additional questions I didn't get to. We're going to try to get back to the individual commenters individually via email. We have that. But otherwise, I want to thank you, Mike, for the presentation. And now we're going to hear from Dr. Jay Gann. Dr. Gann is a professor of environmental chemistry and a water quality specialist in the Department of Environmental Sciences at the University of California, Riverside. His research interests include the environmental chemistry and toxicology of classic and emerging contaminants in the transformation, transport, and bioavailability, plant uptake, and risk mitigation of organic chemicals in the environment, as well as method development for trace contaminant analysis. Dr. Gann has a BS and PhD in environmental science from the Zhejiang University in China, and completed postdoctoral work in agrochemicals at the UN International Atomic Energy Agency's laboratories in Austria, and postdoc work in environmental chemistry at the University of Minnesota. So Dr. Gann, I'm going to turn it over to you now.
Okay, Carl, thank you for the nice introduction. First of all, I want to thank SRP program for the continuous funding. And not only we have produced a whole list of many different types of research publications, but also we have been able to produce some young researchers. So today I'm presenting on behalf of my co-PI, Professor Daniel Schenk. He's an aquatic toxicologist. And also today the content mainly is from a PhD student, Allison Taylor. She's going to defend in a few months, actually. And also a postdoc, Jay Wan, is currently an associate professor at Chinese Agricultural University. So the title of my talk today, presentation, is Effect of Aging on Contaminant Bioavailability. And the focus of this presentation is on what we call hydrophobic organic contaminants, like what the previous speaker also mentioned about PAHs. But here we're going to focus more on chlorinated pesticides and PCBs. Those are really old chemicals. And I think PAHs, some of PAHs fall under the same category in terms of aging, and dioxins as well. So when we talk about these chemicals, these priority contaminants, I think there are two facts we normally we know, but we don't normally appreciate these two facts. One is these chemicals, they are strongly hydrophobic, and the KOW is very high. And for PCB, for example, the KOW increases as the number of chlorines increases. Could be in the range, like KOW could be, you know, well above 7. Same can be said for DDTs and dioxins and for some of the PAHs. So that's fact one. The fact two is these chemicals, they have been in the environment for a long time. Especially, I think that's very true for PCBs and the DDT, because those compounds were used many, many years ago. The reason they're still relevant today is because they have very long persistence. But on the other hand, we can see that the chemicals have stayed around for a long time, or they have aged. For other compounds like PAHs, as we know, they are still being released into the environment. But I think it's fair to say because of their non-persistence, some of the pHs are very old. Some of the pH residues we're seeing today could be from, you know, a few months ago or from a few years ago. So in the example of DDT, for example, we all know that was a miracle insecticide for a time, saved a lot of lives, but it was made use during World War II. And in the U.S., the production and use of DDT was banned in 1972. So that's why you can see that some of the pictures you can get from online, those are black and white. However, I think it's fair to say that all the residues, all the DDT molecules, almost all the DDT molecules we're seeing today in the environment, they are really from 40, 50 years ago in this country. And in many other parts of the world, most likely also 30, 40, 50 years ago. So they have been in the environment for a long time. And that brings question of aging. So if you look at, for example, just use this benzene rings as an example for to represent these hydrophobic compounds. If you look at a microscopic level, let's just say we're looking at a soil aggregate or a sediment particle. If you look at a microscopic level, you can see, we can say that some of the contaminant molecules are probably in the pore water, like the previous speaker just mentioned. Some of the molecules could be attached to the surface of the aggregate. And then there will be some molecules that could have, since they have been there for such a long time, they could have diffused to some of the inner or less accessible pores. They could have been there. They'll never be able to come up. So let's just use yellow color here to represent the freely dissolved molecules in the pore water. Then we use the green to represent the molecules or the contaminants that are attached to the surface. That's the interface. Then we can use the red one to represent the fraction of the molecules that are really embedded into the matrix. And they are very unlikely to be accessible to microbes or to benthic invertebrates, for example. So looking at a microscopic level, we can have these three forms of residues, even though in most cases we're looking only at the total concentration. But in reality, in terms of bioavailability, we have three levels of bioavailability. And over time, again, these chemicals have been there in the soil or sediment for many, many years. You can imagine over time, due to microbial degradation, some chemicals will become degraded. And the yellow one, for example, the ones that are in the dissolved in the pore water will go first. Okay. Then after that, the molecules that are absorbed on the surface, I'm going to use the arrow here, they can become dissolved into the solution. Then they can become degraded by the microbes. And these chemicals, they also can go away over time. And the red ones, the ones that are really locked inside these aggregates, they are less accessible, and very likely they're going to stay there. So in that case, the residues we're seeing today of these molecules, these hydrophobic compounds in sediment or soil, most likely you're looking at a composition here. Even though the concentration we see, they can pretty much, you know, still very high, but the composition of these different forms of this contaminant have changed. The fraction of the non-accessible, the red one, has relatively increased because the bioaccessible or the freely dissolved ones, they have been depleted over time due to microbial degradation and some other diffusion, some other processes, because they are less, they're more accessible. So this is the basis, I think, of aging, because as time goes on, chemicals, the residue composition has changed, the profile has changed, and the residues have become less and less bioavailable. So here I'm going to use a simple diagram to show you how people normally do things. First of all, we typically measure total concentration. Like, you know, we take a grab of a sediment sample, soil sample, then we do a harsh solvent extraction. So here we're really including all three forms, the freely dissolved, the reversibly bond, and also the irreversibly bond fractions, so we get total concentration. And if we want to know the bioaccessible fraction, then what we do is we use a different method to selectively to measure reversibly bond or freely dissolved concentration. Only these two fractions, we exclude this irreversibly bond fraction. So this is a bioaccessibility. Then we have just heard about passive sampling. Passive sampling really works on the principle of equilibrium sampling. You are basically put a little bit of a polymer-based solvent and hoping that it'll reach equilibrium with your freely dissolved concentration. So what you see here reflects the concentration in the pore water. So those are the three forms of different analytical methods to get at three different forms of these concentrations. So this bioavailability, of course, has been studied very extensively for metals. And I think its application for hydrophobic organic contaminants is relatively limited. But in recent 10, 15 years, it has also become very important. So, but again, in terms of bioavailability, we're talking about the freely dissolved concentration, or C3, or bioaccessibility. And however, in most cases, we're only measuring or caring about total concentration in the sediment, or the bulk concentration. And between this bulk concentration and the ecological risk, there's a gap. And we think the bioavailability really bridges these two endpoints, you may say. So I think this is where the bioavailability concept really is useful. That basically bridges the gap between the chemist and the toxicologist, you may say. So to make the data more meaningful. And there are many different ways over the years people have tried to develop different techniques. Here I just made a list of the bioaccessibility method and also the methods for measuring C3. C3, as you can see here, most of the methods are based on passive sampling. And in my group, in our group, we have worked very extensively using TANX, which is a very convenient, very simple technique. And also we have developed a new method. It's called isotope dilution method. And for C3, we have been working on the use of polyethylene films, for example, film-based passive samplers, also SPME. And today, I'm going to give you just two examples, two publications, in fact, based on the use of TANX and also bioaccumulation. We have done some other work, some other studies, but because of time, I will not be able to talk about them. The first study I want to mention here is a study done by Allison, our PhD student. And this is on the Palos Verdes Superfund site. And a little background about this Superfund site is this Superfund site actually is in the ocean. Oh, I cannot see the arrow here. Okay. So this is off the coast of LA, Los Angeles. This red area, it's the Palos Verdes shelf, the Superfund site. Now, the reason it's called Palos Verdes shelf is because this is the Palos Verdes peninsula. Over many, many years, almost a century, you can see here is the LA, large LA county. They have a lot of wastewater treatment plants. So they have been discharging their treated wastewater through this undersea, these three big pipes, about 1 mile off the coast into this ocean. And over many, many years, you can imagine that organic matter has accumulated on the floor, the ocean floor. So this has basically formed a very large area of sediment layer with rich organic matter. On the other hand, in the early, probably 1950s, 1970s, not far from here, there was a DDT manufacturing company, as called Mantrose, chemical company. And they were like the biggest DDT producer back in North America back then. So they also discharged some of their waste into the same, through the same pipes into this area. So you have organic matter, then you have DDT and PCBs. You can imagine that, you know, they will, you know, these two will bind together very quickly. And so that's the Superfund site. The question we have, we want to ask ourselves is, you know, these DDTs and PCBs, they are there. They still have very high concentration, but it's how bioavailable are they? Because they have undergone extensive aging, like 40, 50 years. And so one study, in this study, what we did is we worked with LA Sanitation District, and so we got some precious sediment cores. And here we're only going to present the data from two sediment cores. One is called 8C, that's right at the wastewater discharge point. One is called 3C, which is a little bit up here. We got this sediment cores, and the first thing we did was to slice them into different segments, small increments, like 2 centimeters a piece. So we used lat to 10 to date the sediment. In other words, by doing this, we were able to establish, you know, the year along the sediment core. You may say that the deeper sediment was older sediment, probably was deposited from a long time ago. Near the surface, you get relatively new sediment that was deposited in recent years. So we did this for both cores. You can see we had a very long time interval, almost over 100 years. And this chart shows you the total concentration, this is the bulk chemical concentration of PCBs and DDTs. Of course, we're not seeing DDT because we're only seeing their metabolites, like DDD, DDE, and PBDE, and OPDDE. And this is 8C. This is 3C. 8C had higher concentration. It's a little hard to see here, but we're seeing like in the tens of ppm, or maybe even the hundreds of ppm of DDT. Still very high concentration of DDT metabolites. PCBs were a little bit less, but nevertheless, the concentrations are still very high. And so I mentioned about 10X. What 10X measured is bioaccessibility, and it gives you a fraction. If the bioavailability is 100% bioavailable, then what you're seeing here would be like one factor of one. If it's less than one, then it's not completely bioavailable. So both for these chemicals, we're only showing DDT data here. For 3C, you can see the fraction, the bioaccessible fraction measured by 10X, only ranged from somewhere between 0.1 something to 0.3. In other words, between 10 to 30% of the residues were really bioaccessible. This is 8C. The numbers are even much smaller because 8C was right at the point of discharge. The organic matter content was really high. You can see here, again, depending on the years, the 10x fraction, the bioaccessible fraction, was from somewhere 0.6, maybe 0.06, to less than 0.15. In other words, it's no more than 15% of the total residue would be bioaccessible in the 8C sediment. So that shows us that, well, this corresponds, again, to this something I just showed you here. The composition has changed. Most of your residues here would not be bioaccessible. Only a small fraction, especially for HC, would be considered bioaccessible. So the conclusions for this study would be DDT residues in this sediment were extensively aged. Due to aging, only a very small fraction of the DDT residues in the sediment could be considered bioaccessible. In this study, if you have, probably you still recall that even near the surface, the DDT bioaccessible fraction was also very small. And we wondered, initially we wondered why. Then it really dawned on us. We thought that DDT residues, even though they were probably still being, you know, washed from the dry land, from the urban area, and deposit onto the surface of this Superfund site. But the residues of DDT coming from elsewhere, they also were extensively aged because nobody had used DDT likely in this area for many, many years. So that's, I think, very important to remember. It doesn't matter where DDT came from, their residues have been around. They have been aged for many years. So implications is the real risk in this kind of sites, Superfund sites, they should be much lower in terms of bioaccumulation than what people can expect from the total concentration. So as you know that for this Superfund site, initially EPA wanted to do gravel capping, and they tried, I think, many years ago and didn't work out. And now they have reverted to basically use monitored natural attenuation. Basically, they're not going to do anything to do monitoring, which I think is a real smart, real sound decision, because when you let the aging process to continue, not only some of the chemicals will become degraded, also they'll become less and less bioavailable. So now I'm going to go to my second, well, this has been published in a paper by Allison and in environmental pollution. So now I'm going to give you a second example. It's also from a publication. I'm going to discuss a new method, a real simple method that we can test aging. So what you're seeing here is, for example, you have a historically contaminated soil from somewhere. You could get a lot of these kind of soils from a lot of places in this country. So you wonder just, you know, how aging has affected the bioavailability of this soil. One thing you can do is, ideally, for example, you compare these. You add some fresh DDT, for example. You do bioaccumulation. But of course, if you add the fresh DDT or DDE, you cannot really separate them on DCMS. So what we thought to do is we add into the same sediment, soil, we add isotope-labeled DDT or PCB. Then we can resolve these on the GCMS or HPLMS. And this, you can imagine that if you calculate the bioaccumulation factor for this earthworm, for example, the bioaccumulation factor for the old residue theoretically should be much smaller compared to their bioaccumulation factor from the isotope-labeled chemicals. So we adopt this approach, and we call this a direct method for comparison. So all you have to do is to spike isolabeled compounds of interest. You measure bioaccumulation. In this case, we did with soil, so we used earthworm. And also we used the sediment from the Palos Verde shelf. We used a native invertebrate to do the same thing, same approach to do bioaccumulation. And also we got a freshwater sediment that was also contaminated with DDTs and PCBs. We used another different invertebrate for bioaccumulation. Of course, since we're talking about bioavailability, also we used 10X just as a chemically based technique to validate the bioaccumulation experiment. Same thing, expect the same thing, except here you add 10X beads, you do desorption, basically 10X again measures the fraction that can easily come out. You can imagine that from the aged non-labeled residue, the relative fraction coming into this 10X beads would be smaller compared to the isolabeled freshly spiked residue. So here are some of the results. And the gray bar, this is the 10X result. Okay, we have two different soils. Then we have two marine sediments. Then we have one freshwater sediment. We use 10X 24-hour desorption. And here you can see that for the aged ones, sometimes, as you can see here, the fractions were very small, if you look at HC. For the freshly spiked isolabeled one, the F24 were much, much higher. You can see close to almost 0.7, 0.8. Still, you have some aging going on because you spike, you let sit, right? So it's not 100%. And here, we're showing the biota sediment or biota soil accumulation factor, basically the residues in the tissue of the concentration in the sediment or soil normalized by FOC or lipid content. Again, we're seeing a very similar trend. The freshly spiked always had higher bioaccumulation potential compared to the aged one. And also, we did a correlation between this bioaccumulation, bioaccumulation in the different worms, and also this 10X measured fractions. You can see there was, given that we had five different samples and three different types of invertebrates, this correlation, I think, was pretty outstanding, you may say. And R squared is 0.282. Also very importantly, you can see that here, the slope, okay, in front of the X, it's almost close to one. In other words, you can see that the 10X is a very simple, easy method to predict the potential bioavailability. And to conclude, compared to freshly spiked chemicals, which is isolabeled compounds, bioaccumulation of H residues was much lower. And the same conclusion was made in marine sediment, freshwater sediment, and soil for different invertebrates and different compounds. And the use of chemically based measurement, in this case 10X, closely predicted bioaccumulation. So I have to say that the use of this approach, even though it's I think it's very simple, very direct, because they're comparing your aged sediment residues against freshly introduced isolabeled compounds. This is a direct comparison. I think it should be a very convincing approach to demonstrate the effect of aging on contaminant bioavailability. And nowadays, we know that isolabeled compounds, they are widely available. Their prices are almost the same as non-labeled compound standard. So all you have to do, we also use a lot of GC-MS or LC-MS. So this technique is very simple and very easy for us to quantify the aging effect. And this paper was just published in ESP Letters by J1 and our group. So I don't have a summary slide, but I just want to point you to this paper that we wrote a few years ago on different methods to assess bioavailability of HOCs. This was in collaboration with Fritz Meyer. He has done a lot of work. He's from Denmark. And also Professor Tree, she's a professor now at Nanjing University. And this really, I think, that gives a good overview about the different techniques and different application scenarios for the different methods to understand bioavailability. I think this has been cited more than 200 times already. It's a very good reference if you haven't seen it yet. With that, I really want to thank again the support from NIH, the SRP program. You know, it's about 8-10 years of funding has really helped us in cultivating some of the best young scientists working on this topic. With that, I'll conclude my talk, and I'll be happy to take some questions.
Well, Dr. Gann, thank you so much for the presentation. I want to remind audience participants that they can ask questions from the Q&A pod. I'm going to move right to a couple of those questions. The first one talks about sediment cleanup levels, that the cleanup numbers are a concentration that are based on risk assessment or ARRs, for example. In your experience, have regulators been willing to accept these bioavailable concentrations at the cleanup threshold, since the bioavailable threshold is always lower than the ARR or risk assessment value?
I think probably we are not there yet, but I think people realize the importance of using these more ecologically relevant numbers instead of the traditional values. But I don't think we're there yet. I shouldn't say more research should be done, but I think we have done a lot of research, and people realize that. I think we have the scientific foundation for really making better use of bioavailability-based measurement.
Okay, great. Thank you. I have another question from a participant about the, I believe, the Palos Verde study that you presented. Were the organism tissue samples analyzed in conjunction with the DDT at that site?
I guess we're talking about the first study. We did analyze. We did also do some simulated exposure in the lab. Yes, we did work on that using native invertebrates. Also, we did work with blackfish by Dr. Schlenk's group. So we worked together on that. Also did some modeling work on that.
Great. Thank you. I have one other question or a couple other questions. One of the participants wants to know, what is 10X?
Okay. 10X is a type of polymer. It has a density that's lighter than water. So it's really easy to use. A lot of people have used these. Basically, it's a hydrophobic polymer becoming to the powders or beads, you may say. So you can mix them with soil or sediment along with water. You can shake it for 5 hours, 10 hours, 12, 24 hours. Then once you centrifuge, these beads will, because they're lighter than water, they'll just float to the top. So you can just pour this through filter paper, collect these 10X beads. The good thing is they act as a sink for these DDTs and PCBs. So whatever that's coming off the sediment or soil particles, they'll get trapped by this 10X. So essentially, you're measuring desorption.
You can
buy these 10X beads from Fisher, from a lot of other places. they are pretty cheap, and you only need a little bit. And basically, we find this to be very reliable, and a lot of people have used 10x for measuring bioaccessibility.
Okay, great. Follow-up question to that. What is the equilibrium time for these, for the 10x feed, for example, for DDT?
Okay, it's I have to say it's you know, this equilibrium. Well, first of all, the trapping of DDTs onto the polymer is very fast because it's very hydrophobic. So once they come into the solution, it'll get trapped by the 10x speeds very quickly. So this equilibrium really depends on the disruption. Sometimes, as we know, DDT can take many days for DDT to come off. So that's why we use F24. We use 24 hours, even though it's not 100%. We are not measuring 100% of the desorption, but we are measuring the bulk of the desorbed fraction. So a lot of people also use the same approach. It's a simplified 24-hour interval. So you just shake it for 24 hours. So you measure F24. Maybe that can account for 80% of the potentially dissolvable fraction instead of 100%.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Yan. Again, at the end of the presentation, if there's additional time to get back to some of the questions we missed, we will. But at this point, we're going to move on to the final presentation of the series today. I'm going to introduce Dr. James Ranville. Dr. Ranville is a professor in the chemistry department at the Colorado School of Mines. A major goal of his current research is to develop robust tools to determine the bioavailability of metals contaminated sites before, during, and after remediation. A part of his research involves the role of colloids and particles in environmental processes. Another aspect of his research deals with aquatic toxicity using Daphnia magna. Dr. Ranville has a bachelor's in chemistry from Lake Superior State University, a master's and a PhD in geochemistry from the Colorado School of Mines, and completed a postdoc in water studies at Monash University in Australia. Dr. Ranville, I'll now turn it over to you.
Well, thank you very much, Carl. Thanks for that introduction, and thank you, everyone, for inviting me to give a overview of some of our work. Actually, I'm going to just pick out one aspect of the things we're doing. As you can see from the title, we're following the changes in the chemistry and biology of a stream that's undergoing full-scale remediation. We're going to change things up quite a bit because we're going from our previous two talks about organics to metals, and we're going from the sort of lowland environment to an alpine stream system. The photographs to illustrate the North Fork watershed with the towns of Black Hawk and Central City located in that watershed. I'd like to start off by acknowledging that this part of this work has been funded by the NIH, obviously. That's why we're talking about it today. And the title of the most recent grant was Looking at Biogeochemical Controls on Metal Mixture Toxicity Using Stable Isotopes and Gene Expression. We've also got some additional funding from a number of metals industry groups, NYPERA, Copper Association, Rio Tinto, and International Zinc to kind of support some of this work. And primarily our metal mixture work, and much of it's been laboratory-based. I want to acknowledge my colleague Joe Meyer here at School of Mines, and then two master's students who've been working on the project, Evan Lloyd and Jill Murphy. Our collaborators at CSU, Will Clements is a colleague and co-PI, and Chris Katalik is his PhD student working on the biology. And then we're working with the University of Florida, Chris Volpe and his student Danny Kachera, in looking at some responses at the genomics level. So if I laid out the overall goals of our overall project, we're really trying to understand how, when you have metal mixtures, how is aquatic toxicology affected through the effect of mixtures on metal bioavailability. And we'd also like to see how these effects translate into how effective is our remediation for mining impacted waters. We're tackling this with both laboratory and field-based approaches. In the lab, we've been working on metal mixtures, both binary and ternary mixtures, using Daphnia magna. We have a number of endpoints, mortality, metal uptake, and gene expression. We've been looking at the bioavailability of metals from some of the sediments in these watersheds using a copper 65 stable isotope labeling technique with snails to test organisms. And we're also directly looking at the processes occurring in the stream, both the biological and chemical responses to the remediation of the mining effluents. And of course, there's no way I can cover all these topics. So today I decided to look at the actual processes occurring in the stream and illustrate what we're seeing with respect to the effectiveness of the remediation and a little bit about how bioavailability plays into this. So we'll have a quick background. I'll describe the site and hydrology, go over a little bit about how water chemistry in the system is responding, the biological recovery, just a brief mention of some of the outreach activities, and then a summary. So the photograph is an image of from about 30 years ago of what our study site looked like. This is Black Hawk, Colorado, with the stream we're studying running through some pretty nasty-looking remains of mining activity. The North Fork of Clear Creek is about 50 kilometers west of Denver. It's all historic mining activities. There's nothing current, but the activities left a residue of solid materials and also lots of effluents from the generate acid mine drainage, particularly the result of sulfide weathering. The reason that this field site dovetails into our work is that we see a mixture of metals present in the stream. We're focusing mostly on copper and zinc, but the question becomes, how do we really assess how those metals interact with one another? And certainly, up until recently, the stream life was highly impacted and essentially absent from areas of the stream. If we jump ahead 30 years, I'm going to see what the system looked like in 2016. The obvious effects of mining are you have these hard armored coatings on the rocks. Get my pointer to work here. We have the water column is filled with loose flocculent material, which also coats the bed. There's dissolved metals and a paucity of aquatic life. And so this was our study site 3 years ago. You might notice right along here we have some experiments going on where we have trays of rocks being coated by this material that we then expose to aquatic organisms to see what are the effects of this extensive metal contamination. So the good news is that after much delay in March of 2017, a high-density sludge plant was put online. They captured the two major point sources of acid mine drainage that enter the stream, Gregory Wing Cline and National Tunnel, and it cost about $20 million, and it cost maybe $500,000 per year to run. But what we're really looking at with this particular aspect of our overall studies is how is this improving the system, both chemically and biologically? So just again, to kind of put the everything in context, we're located So we're located just west of Denver. This is our study site. It includes some reference sites that are non-contaminated. The regions around the mining activity, historical mining activity, there's a gauging station operated by the USGS just above the confluence of the main stem of Clear Creek, so we can do load calculations and see, again, how effective are we removing metals in the system. So you'll see some of these sites referred to, again, as the talk goes along. So the research goals are to monitor the water chemistry and the biology, both pre- and post-remediation, understand the effectiveness of the treatment plant in decreasing the metal loads, understand how the geochemistry of the water column changes since the implementation of the treatment, and evaluate the potential aquatic toxicity of any residual dissolved metals. In order to understand the system, you have to recognize the hydrology is variable and it really drives the water chemistry. What we see in these kinds of stream systems is that during the spring, May, June, we have snow melt and we have a substantial increase in the discharge. This acts to scour the sediments, and then as it declines over the summer, we have these base flow conditions where essentially we're seeing groundwater recharge the stream and very little inputs from the watershed itself. The remediation occurred right here in mid-March, so everything shown on this graph is happening in the 2 years following the remediation, with the sampling points indicated as the red triangles. So what's happening with the chemistry? Well, the first thing one notes is that you can see a marked visual improvement in the system. This is our pre-remediation condition, the site downstream, just before it enters the main stem of Clear Creek. You can see that as the water hydrology, the discharge increases with snow melt, we get this flushing event. And by October of that year, we see really something that's been remarkably restored just through natural processes in the very first year. There were some intermediate or intermittent treatment processes going on throughout this system, this time period, but after September 15th, the treatment was continuous. So the question is we see an obvious visual improvement in the system, but what's going on chemically? If we look at total loads, these are calculated by taking the water composition at the USGS site. This will be the last site in the stream before it enters the main stem of Clear Creek. And calculate loads, we can see that after remediation, we've seen a dramatic decrease in the iron load by a factor of 1,600. So the treatment plant is effectively removing iron from these two major sources, and it's being lost to the system. And this is consistent with the visualization I just showed before. These iron oxide coatings are going away. We had quite a bit less removal of zinc load. We see about a 50-fold decrease in zinc with time, and an intermediate amount of decrease in the copper load, about 150-fold decrease. You might note that there's this little data point here, here and here. This is the next runoff. This is 2018 runoff, where we're seeing scouring of those bed sediments. So we're very curious to continue this process through the next series of summer events and see whether we're just seeing a decrease in this scouring event as the sediments are improved with time. If we kind of say, well, how are we doing in terms of restoring the stream to previous conditions? Well, it's always difficult to know what a system that has mineralization in the watershed is going to look like prior to mining. But the red line I'm showing here represents taking the upstream reference water chemistry, the uncontaminated water, and using the base flow conditions at that USGS site to compute what would be the load if all we had were upstream water moving through the system. What you can see is we've come down pretty close to what we might predict as an uncontaminated load for iron. But again, we're still quite a bit above what we'd expect for zinc, and perhaps we're approaching copper a little more closely. So the result, or the cause of this, is that there are still some sources that we're not captured in the remediation process. If we look at what happens to the chemistry in going from reference site 1, which is truly background, to reference site 2, which turns out to be not quite background, we see that we're seeing a substantial percentage increase in zinc between those two reference sites. We get a little more zinc as we move downstream, as the cartoon shows, but then we start seeing copper coming into the system. The ratio of copper to zinc is variable. And so it means that this doesn't just represent some acid mine treatment or acid mine effluents that haven't been treated, but very unique water chemistries. You can see this also in the zinc to sulfate ratio and the copper to sulfate ratio. Again, these are the site. This is the reference site, and then when we start getting these untreated sources, we see a bump up in the zinc to sulfate ratio. Between these two sites is where the treatment plant discharges, and the treatment plant is not effective at removing sulfate. So we see a drop in the zinc to sulfate ratio due to this introduction of sulfate from the treatment plant. It seems relatively constant in this case, whereas, again, as we move down through the system, the copper sulfate ratio is changing. In fact, the effluents that are entering the stream are becoming more copper-rich relative to the sulfate. So again, this bears directly on when we start thinking about, well, how do we deal with the fact that metals may act synergistically or antagonistically in mixtures when we start changing these relative ratios. If we look at concentrations, what we see with iron is that we almost immediately remove the iron from the system, and iron concentrations are very, very low. This is very much mirrors what we saw in the load calculation we had before. But if we look at copper, something a little different happens. Although, if you recall, we did see a dramatic decrease in the total copper, the copper load, the amount of dissolved copper is only reduced slightly by maybe a factor of two. So the concern we have here is that aquatic species are not concerned about loads, but they're concerned about the concentration, particularly the dissolved concentration of a metal. So what we think is that we like to say that particulate iron is your friend. If you just look at a typical kind of pH versus absorption curve for copper, you'd expect that in our pH regime, we would have a lot of copper bound to the particulates. If we look at the plot of particulate iron versus dissolved copper content, pre-remediation is when we have fairly high particulate iron present and we have very low percent dissolved copper. So as we cleaned up the system, we dropped the amount of particulate iron, and that allowed a greater residual amount of dissolved copper to stay in solution. So this is a bit of an unexpected consequence that when you remove something like an absorbing phase, you're actually promoting the retention of a dissolved species in solution. If we take a look at how might we assess the impact of this residual metal that we're not removing from the stream, we were looking at our laboratory studies of Daphnia magna toxicity, where we've been looking at the combinations of copper and zinc in laboratory setting. And we can relate the toxicity the mortality to the concept of toxic units. For any given solution, how does our metal relate to the EC50, the effective concentration of that metal? And we can present the data in terms of toxic units. If we just take a simple additive model, we would say the predicted mortality is a sum of the toxic units. So we did these calculations for the water chemistry of one of the sites. And so, as you can see, before we did any treatment, we had a prediction of about 90% mortality for that water composition. Now, not only does the concentration of the metal affect mortality, but of course, the composition of the water, hardness, dissolved organic matter, pH, other factors affect the toxicity of the metals, and in this case, the predicted toxicity based on our modeling. So things like dilution not only remove the copper, but change the water composition, and so we see this sort of cycle where you can see these effects where the mortality or the predicted toxicity is lowest during the runoff events. But during these base flow conditions later in the year, even after remediation, we're still seeing a fair amount of predicted toxicity. It appears to maybe be going down in time, so maybe another year of flushing in the system, we'll see even less toxicity in 2019. This is a prediction, again, based on the idea that we can look at metals binding to the biotic ligand on an organism, but we'd also like to look at the system directly and go to the biology. Before we go to the biology, let me just summarize that the treatment plant is effective in removing loads to different degrees for different metals, but there remain these uncaptured sources of metal that still contribute potentially toxic elements. The removal of iron, although probably a good thing, did have this unexpected consequence of allowing more dissolved copper to be present in the water, and it did not affect the zinc speciation much at all. We still see some elevated predicted mortalities post-remediation. Idea: we cannot treat what we don't capture. If we look at the field biomonitoring, okay, so we've seen that the chemistry of the stream seems to respond quite quickly. post-remediation. How quickly do these biological endpoints or these conditions change? How soon, how quickly do we see the algal biomass return? How quickly will the benthic macroinvertebrates increase in abundance and the number of organisms? And not only the benthic organisms, but then the emerging adults, how will they be affected by the restoration of the stream? If we look at the biology, we just take a quick look at, we're going to talk about recovery sites and impact sites and reference sites and looking at this. What do we see with respect to algae? The upstream site seems to be pretty constant in the amount of algal biomass as measured by chlorophyll A throughout the study period. What we see is a continued, it's still depleted at that recovery site, the lowest downstream, but it's starting to increase at the impact site, the intermediate site, which is a little bit surprising. You'd think maybe that the lowest site would be restored more quickly, but we're not seeing that. And I think we'll see in the next data that this is a consequence of the fact that we don't have quite a healthy stream ecosystem that is balancing the grazing organisms that would eat the algae, but then are eaten by predators. This is the total abundance of organisms in our sampling. Again, this is on a log scale now, so if you note after the remediation, we're seeing a continual increase in the number of organisms at the impact site and the recovery site. But if you compare this, there's still maybe a factor of five or so fewer organisms at the impact site than the reference site. What's more concerning is that we do not have a healthy ecosystem. The number of species has barely increased, maybe doubled at the impact sites, and is still only about a quarter of the number of species that we see at the reference site. So if you recall back, the images I showed show a stream that looks quite clean, the water chemistry has improved, but the biology is still, 2 years after remediation, still on its way back and has not recovered yet. Finally, last slide, I believe, just to point out, if we could look at what's happening with respect to both the benthic biomass, so we have a target of trying to bring the dry biomass in the stream back up to this reference site. The recovery site's coming up to near background levels, but the impact site in terms of the actual biomass is still low. Second year, we're starting to see a little bit closer to the background site. The emergent biomass, these are the organisms, the midges that leave the stream, then become flies, and then become part of the terrestrial ecosystem, they're starting to come back finally. So perhaps we are seeing a few things that are looking very positive for the site. There is a discrepancy in the algal colonization. We think this is due to the top-down control by grazers. Some sites, the grazers are there to keep the algae down, but the predators are not there to put the grazers in control. So it's still a little bit of out of whack biologically. We are seeing some recovery in the number of organisms, but there's still far too few organisms to consider this a healthy stream. And we are seeing improvements with time. Finally, we've been doing some outreach activities. We've been involving field trips for K-12 students. School Minds has a number of summer programs. We've taken a number of groups out where they can look at the impacts on the stream. They can see how the system is being treated with the water treatment process and the sources, the tunnels that release the metals. And in addition to the K-12, at the university level, this site is used as part of our field session at the, for undergrads in the environmental chemistry field. And we're also working with local stakeholders, including the Clear Creek Watershed Foundation, to try to get the information out to what are we doing in terms of monitoring the health of the stream following remediation. With that, I will be happy to try to take any questions that might arise regarding the study site. Thank you.
And Carl, just to confirm that you're still on the line, you may be muted.
Yep. Apologize for that. I was muted. Yeah, I Appreciate the presentation. Appreciate the information that you provided to us. Had a question to get us started, and then we'll move over to the participant questions. So you showed that some of your parameters quite weren't where you would expect from your reference or your unimpacted systems. And you made mention of the timing of that. Is that timing sort of behind what you would expect from the natural progression and recovery? And if so, what do you think is holding it back?
Well, I think that we have seen in other study sites that there is a lag time to restore, an ecosystem back to full health. I think that these few residual sources of metals may be holding things back. It's a little too soon to tell. Certainly, the metal loads were greatly reduced and the metal concentration, but not fully. So we really need one more year to see whether have we stalled out or are we still continuing on an upward trend. So we can plan to continue to sample throughout this year, and I think that one more year of looking at this will really start to tell us whether we're going to get back to a healthy system or we didn't fully realize the remediation we'd hoped.
Great, thank you. Question from one of the participants, and it's along a similar vein. Have any studies been done over a longer time frame that show continued improvement to stream health?
Yeah, there's a few studies, mostly on the Clark Fork River, I believe, that have shown that it can take a decade for some of the very sensitive species to recover. I probably have to punt on this one a little bit and have you talk to one of our biologists who could specifically follow up on which species are the ones that are very slow to recover, as opposed to things that obviously the algae seems to have come back almost immediately, but now it's out of balance because you don't have the grazer predator food web established yet.
Thank you. What was the specific method that was used for the metal remediation, and was it the same for all three types of metals?
Yeah, so it's a very conventional remediation process. The major acid mine drainage waters are diverted into the plant I showed. It's a lime treatment system. The pH is raised to about 11. The metals precipitate out. There's a bit of a flocculant polymer added. Then the pH is readjusted down and released to the stream. The treatment system itself was working quite well. It's really this residual sources of metals that have unique chemical signatures, which to me was a bit of a surprise that copper zinc ratios weren't more uniform. There's in-stream geochemistry and geochemistry happening within the stream bed, I think, that alter the chemical makeup of the waters. But as far as the remediation itself, it's straightforward, and it pretty much removes not greater than 99% of the metals from the effluent that is being treated.
Great, thank you. And another comment that relates back to sort of the timing of recovery, and it's, are we asking too much to – Are we asking too much to expect an ecosystem to recover in a few years when it took over 100 years to establish the degraded condition? The EPT species tend to take a long time to recolonize, which would be indicative of a climax recovery community.
Yeah, probably correct. Maybe, again, my biology colleagues might answer this question a little more directly, but I do think that it probably is remarkable that we've gotten as far as we have in these species in 2 years. And so I think we're probably hopeful that that the third year will show even more improvement to get these very sensitive EPT species back to where they belong.
Yeah, and I can say that, from my perspective, looking at remediation on sites, it is promising to see a fast response that's measurable and related to the remediation. So I thought that was promising. One of the things that I thought about in looking at your presentation is we see a lot of sort of the species and species and indicators that might be more associated with the water column. Has all the particulate load that's moved into the system, is it still retained within the pore water of the sediment bed? And are you seeing effects there, or are you measuring effects in that region?
Yeah, so it becomes difficult to look too much in the pore waters because this is a very dynamic, high gradient stream. So it's boulders and cobbles. There are some areas of fine sediment, but for the most part, you know, we're following the water column because of the difficulty in following the sediments. In addition to removal and scouring, which we think we can see in the water column particulate metal loads that we calculate. You have sand and other fine grain materials moving from the uncontaminated region upstream, downstream. And so a lot of our actual contaminated sediments might be getting buried. So that does lead one to think that maybe there could be some interesting pore water chemistry things to follow up on. But for the most part, we're kind of seeing this system flushing itself. And those sediments, I do think those armored coatings may persist for some time. And as I mentioned, I didn't have time to talk about the isotope experiments we're doing, but we are labeling organisms with copper 65 and then exposing them to different kinds of sediments, both loose and armored, to see to what degree are any metals associated with those sort of persistent sediments, to what degree are they bioavailable. And we'll have those results in the near future.
Great, thank you. On the remediation system, is this the type of system where it is going to need to basically run in perpetuity?
Correct. In fact, when we get the kids out there and some of these outreach activities, I always ask them that question, when do you think we can turn this off? And I usually say, well, you know, it's going to run forever until greater issues arise for mankind. There is no effective way of prevention of this, the process of acid mine drainage. Plugging these tunnels can lead to dire consequences of, as some might recognize, in the Gold King spill and things like that. So the plant should run forever for all foreseeable scenarios.
Okay, well, thank you so much. If there are any participants that are on the phone that would like to use the phone lines instead of the text box, you can take your phone off mute by pressing #6, or you can ask a question. Otherwise, we're still monitoring the text box if there are any additional questions. Okay, so if not, then I think that what we can do is we can open up a couple of additional questions. We have a couple of additional. Thank you, Dr. Ranville. Excellent presentation, as mentioned. We have just a couple minutes. I think that we should use them if possible. And if we still have all of our presenters on, which I'm sure we do, one of the things I'd like to do is move back to some of our earliest questions. One of them came in about the biosensor methods, and we talked about comparing the biosensor message to SPEMES. And we were wondering, or the participant was wondering, was whether or not the those data were going to be available in the near term.
Yeah, that's an ongoing study. We still plan another phase of that study. One of our issues was we wanted to use real environmental samples, and we ended up with a batch of samples where the pore water concentrations were really low and just a few that were really high. So we're working on filling in the gap in between to bolster that correlation. So it'll be hopefully by the end of the year that'll be available.
Great. Thank you. One of the other questions that arose regarding the issue of the development of cleanup levels, considering bioavailability and the bioaccessibility from Dr. Dr. Gan, we talked about this a little bit, and one of the questions is that, so if you're going to consider this bioavailability, what impact is that going to have on your cleanup levels? So the participants suggest that the cleanup levels might be higher. Is that your take on it as well, Dr. Gan?
That's a good question. We have done some work, but I didn't have time to talk about it. To apply this concept in remediation practices. I mean, first of all, I think we can use this, in determining if we need to do remediation in the first place or not. If we do, like how big an area we should do, I think based instead of the bulk concentration, we can base on our the action on bioavailability. And the second application, I would say, it could be very useful is also to monitor the remediation effectiveness by using this concept. If you think, I think our first speaker also mentioned, in many cases, for soil or sediment, what we try to do really in terms of remediation is try to immobilize. We add some solvent into the sediment and to reduce the flux from the sediment to water, for example. In that case, we're not really changing anything to the total concentration. We're basically just reducing the bioaccessibility or bioavailability. We just lock up the chemicals in the same spot. So in that case, we can apply this concept. We can, instead of measuring the total concentration, which will not make any sense, we just measure the free concentration or the bioaccessible concentration, which will be much more meaningful.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I think that these are obviously issues that are subject to ongoing conversations, ongoing research, of course, and appreciate the SRP's efforts in funding this type of research to advance the science and advance the practice for the in the Superfund community. We've reached a time now where we have to start where we have to finalize our presentations for today. But before we conclude, I want to make sure that everyone's aware of the pod in here, the related URLs. It contains the seminar resources and seminar feedback links. On the resources page, there are resources that are directly applicable to today's topic. It's going to stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. And we place the seminars in an archive with this soundtrack. In the near future, you're going to be able to access the slides and hear the presentations as it was given today. In the related URLs pod, you're going to find an online seminar feedback form. Please consider filling out this online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and the delivery mechanisms. I would like to remind participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure you don't miss any of the webinars. For more information on these webinars, please refer to the CLUIN.org's website. You can also subscribe to their monthly e-newsletter, the Tech Direct, and follow CLUIN on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. So we encourage you to visit the SRP website for more information about the program. You can also follow SRP on Twitter. I'd like to encourage everyone to join us for the final session in this series. It's going to be on May 20th at 1 p.m. In the third session, we're going to hear from Dr. Helen Soo Kim at Duke University and Dr. Upal Ghosh from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Visit the CLUIN registration pages for more information and to register. So with that, time to conclude today's webinar. If you submitted an online question and we did not have time to get to it, which there was just one or two, we're going to have to pass those questions along to the presenters who can follow up. If you have additional questions, you can also contact the presenters via email. Their email addresses are on the seminar homepage on CLUIN. So thank you to our presenters, Mike Unger.